You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
Joining me on the line is Gary Sick. Gary, thanks for joining us today.
Pleasure.
Gary, I just finished your wonderful book, All Fall Down, America's Tragic Encounter with Iran, which, as I told you prior to the interview, I've had this book for over 30 years, and I finally got to it. I wish I would have gotten to it a lot earlier, but it was fantastic. We can't get into it in great detail because you're heading out of town, but I want to get into it in some detail, and perhaps we can talk again in the future. But before that, for the benefit of the listeners, could you give them a little bit of background about who you are?
Basically, I was a U.S. Naval officer for 24 years. The last 6 years of my Navy career were spent in the White House, in the National Security Council, where I was responsible for Iran and the Arabian Peninsula. And basically, this time coincided with the Iranian Revolution and the hostage crisis. So that's really where I got my deep interest in Iran, and whatever expertise I have was born during that period of time. Since that time, I've worked for the Ford Foundation, and I also been an adjunct professor at Columbia University for, I guess, almost 30 years. And I've written a couple of books on U.S. foreign policy in the Persian Gulf. And that's sort of my background, and I'm happy to answer whatever questions you have.
Thank you for explaining that, Gary. Appreciate it. Of course, I guess most people would recognize your name from the term October Surprise. We'll get into that at the end if we could, but right now, getting into the book, and I do have many questions. It was a fantastic book. But I guess the first question I would have is, the book was approached from a policy standpoint, and I think that's very significant. So if you wouldn't mind, for the benefit of the listeners, could you explain to them what that actually means, what that entails, how you wrote this tale from a policy standpoint? What does that exactly mean?
Well, I was the NSC advisor on Iran during the revolution and the hostage crisis. And what this book is trying to do is simply to inform other people what it looked like being in that position at that time. And the book is based almost 100% on my own experiences, the people I talked to, the meetings that I was in. I was actually in the NSC. My job meant that I was the note taker in a lot of meetings that took place. I'm not a decision maker myself. I certainly never claimed to be. But I was certainly around when a lot of decisions got taken. And I think it's interesting for people who have not been in that position to sort of see what goes on, the way it's done. And I tried to simply tell the story as clearly and accurately as I possibly could. And that's really where the book came from.
Yes, thank you for explaining that. And I learned a whole heck of a lot from it. And there are, as I explained to you prior to going live here in the interview, that I have 8 pages of notes, which unfortunately we're not going to be able to get to at this point. Some of the more fascinating points of the book, and I would suggest that folks get the book on their own. This, of course, is from 1985, 86, I think it was, the copyright in there, but one of the originals. So get this book, All Fall Down, and find out for yourself, because obviously we can't talk about it all. It's about 400, a little bit over 400 pages, not counting the notes. But in a nutshell, how you describe the crisis and how it unfolded, I guess it might have been due to the fact that the Shah was pretty much supreme, and the way that he handled, for example, his military commanders was that they all answered to him. And then after his abdication, it seemed like, from the way you were explaining it, there was total disarray in the country. Nobody knew what to do, and that, of course, might have lent to the amount of time it took to swing a deal to get the hostages out. And I loved how you explained about the students. You said basically they thought they were just going to be there for a couple of days, but after they began to receive accolades from the country and especially from Khomeini, the thing went on and on. On page 46, you say more than 99% of all events in international politics can be adequately explained and dealt with by a foreign policy structure based on the triple assumptions of rational action, incremental change, and partial control. How did it go from a situation where the United States and Iran were joined at the hip, basically, to the point where you explained that President Nixon had this deal directly with the Shah that he would get these weapons, almost on the president's word? How did it go from a situation where the two countries were so closely aligned to the United States, it appears, to becoming the great Satan in such a short amount of time?
Basically, after 1953, when the United States conspired together with the British to put the Shah back on the throne after he left the country because he was worried about Prime Minister Mossadegh taking over, nationalizing the oil and so forth. He was worried about his future. And the United States and Great Britain together helped to change that and make it possible for the Shah to return. From that point on, up until the time of the revolution, and certainly during the time of Nixon and Kissinger, the United States was dealing with the Shah directly as the representative of Iran. Now, that's not unusual for a head of state to act as the representative. On the other hand, the kinds of discussions that went on, the deals that were made, were really highly personal. They were done between the United States and a particular individual, the Shah. And it was not with the government, with really the country of Iran. It was with that one man. That is always a very dangerous thing to do, because you may have a leader who is amenable, who actually wants to do business with you, but individuals are not only mortal, but are subject to change. And what happened was that the Shah, although he was quite willing to deal with us, was having really severe problems as far as holding his country together. And the opposition to the Shah grew very dramatically during that period of time. And ultimately, without going into a lot of the details, the Shah was overthrown, as we all know. He left the country in January of 1979. The revolution started in January of 1978 for all practical purposes, and it was over with the Shah out of the country by January of 1979. So in a 12-month period, we went from having a relationship with an individual to having no individual there to have a relationship with, and a very hostile government that replaced the Shah, which saw the United States as very much part of what they were opposing. Their opposition to the Shah, they saw him as an American puppet, and that as a result, we were equally responsible for what happened in Iran. I don't agree with that, and I think they were incorrect. In fact, the Shah spent more time preaching to us than we did giving orders to him. But be that as it may, that was where we got to the period after the revolution. The Shah himself was, in many ways, much more concerned about a military takeover in Iran than he was about the mullahs. And he very carefully made sure that his military forces were at odds with each other. So he appointed the heads of different services, the Army, Navy, Air Force, and so forth, people who hated each other and who absolutely would not work together. And he promoted that kind of rivalry between the parties. So after he left the country, the only institution that was left that might, in fact, have maintained the monarchy and the relationship with the United States was the military. And the United States hoped that the military would stand up, bring some kind of order to the country, and save the system as it was. The military, however, the way it had been run by the Shah, made it almost impossible for those organizations to work together. And so the military collapsed. And when the military collapsed, the Khomeini people and the revolution took over. That's a very thumbnail sketch of what happened, but I think it's an accurate sketch. His dealings with the military don't explain everything. It certainly doesn't explain the origins of the revolution, the opposition to the Shah himself, all of the other parties inside. Revolutions are very complicated, messy, and in many cases, mysterious, because we don't really understand the thinking and actions of everybody that was involved. But in final analysis, when the moment came when some institution had to either be created or stand up to defend the monarchy and defend the system as it was, the military in Iran fell short and was unwilling and unable to do that. And that was the key moment in which the revolution really took over. This, of course, is a completely different subject than the other one you raised, which is the hostage crisis. That was an outgrowth of the revolution, but it was not really related to that whole set of issues dealing with the military and the like. By the time we got to the hostage crisis, the United States discovered that the Shah of Iran was deathly ill. He was by that time living in Mexico, and there was tremendous pressure brought on Jimmy Carter to bring him to the United States for medical attention. That very fateful decision that was made by Carter against his better judgment turned out to be the turning point for what many people regard as the second revolution, which is the United States found itself not only at odds with the government of Iran, but in fact, we had ended up breaking relations and has poisoned the relationship between the two, actually from that moment until now. The students who decided to take the embassy did that with the understanding they thought that they were there for a sit-in, and they would make a political point saying that the Shah should be returned to Iran for trial, And they decided to make that point, and then they thought the government would intervene and say, all right, you've made your point, it's time to go home. And instead, the government joined them in their opposition, and that turned it into an international crisis that actually ran for 444 days. Which, of course, I had a number of friends who were present in the embassy at that time and who were held hostage. Most of us in the government at that time did. It was a very personal thing, and it was very personal for Jimmy Carter. He really cared about the hostages. He took it personally. He felt that to a considerable degree it was his fault. He took responsibility for bringing the Shah into the country and setting off this crisis, and he took personal responsibility for the health and safety of all the hostages. One can argue with how he went about dealing with the problem, but the reality is that after 444 days, the hostages were returned safe and sound to the United States and still in remarkably good health under the circumstances. And that then set the agenda for what has been happening for the last more than 30 years as the United States and Iran have jockeyed with each other for position. And in fact, as we know today, that decision, that poisoning of the environment, could not be more obvious than it is this very day when Secretary Pompeo has been up on the Hill talking about the terrible things that Iran does and how we have to ignore the problems of Saudi Arabia because we need them in the fight against Iran. So that basically has transformed U.S. foreign policy in the region basically from that day, from the day of the revolution to the present. The presence of Iran and its influence in the region has become a dominant characteristic of our policy. That concern about that has become a major concern. So basically, the story that I tell in the book describes how that happened, the fall of the Shah and the hostage crisis. I think the importance of the book is that this has lessons for us in our relations with other countries, where we're likely to be dealing with an individual rather than a whole country. And it also has real lessons for us about the kinds of implications that that can carry for the United States in an entire region, in this case, the whole Middle East.
Thank you for explaining it like that, Gary. You know, you did really give a lot of insight into this man, Jimmy Carter, and it was wonderful. And I'm sure that there are not very many people who realize how this played out literally down to the wire. You explain it wonderfully about when you walked out and you saw, I'm not going to spoil it here for the readers, but how you walked out and you saw the different photographs on the wall. They can find out for themselves. But Jimmy Carter took it very seriously. I'm in contact with President Carter over a different matter, but he's a great man, and you took it very seriously. On page 260, you said, I remember discussing the crisis with my family shortly after the hostages were seized and telling them that until the hostages were freed, their welfare would take priority over everything else in my life. I found that pretty powerful. You basically put everything else on hold to take care of these people that you might not have even known very well, right?
Yeah, some of them I did know quite well. Others I knew mostly by reputation, but several of them I had met just before they went out to take their positions in Tehran. The hostage crisis became a sort of national obsession. There was nothing else on the radio. There was nothing else on TV. This was really the first televised American foreign policy crisis. It was on TV every single night for 444 days. We had announcers counting down the days, how many days the hostage crisis had been going on. Americans couldn't get away from it, and I couldn't get away from it, of course. I wish that we'd been more successful more quickly, and I think that view is shared by everybody who was involved or even those who weren't involved with the crisis. But the reality was, primarily because of domestic Iranian politics, where in some respects, the reason Khomeini threw his support to the students and basically turned them from political science types who were having a sit-in to wardens of a prison, which they were then responsible for managing for more than a year. The way that that came about was because Khomeini was worried that his revolution was going to go off the rails. Basically, he was afraid that the people who had carried out the revolution were very much against the Shah. On that, they were united, but they weren't very well united on what they wanted to come out of that. So what was going to follow the revolution? And the reality is that they were not, for the most part, all that enthusiastic about the fact that they were going to have a theocratic state ruled by the clergy. That's not what they had anticipated. They had marched in the street for greater freedom. greater human rights, greater rights for women, for a whole range of things that they were interested in. But Khomeini, in effect, captured the revolution after it was over and began to impose this idea of a theocratic regime, which a lot of Iranians didn't really agree with at all. And as he saw that faltering, the hostage crisis came along just at the moment when he could create a crisis with the United States, which rallied all of the Iranian people around him. It put aside all of these questions of the theocratic regime. And by the time it was over, the time the hostage crisis was solved, he was firmly in power. And all of the enemies of the revolution, as he would put it, those who were much more moderate, those who were committed to a different outcome, they were gone. They had been fired, they had disappeared, they were off in exile, or they were under repressive control. And so basically the hostage crisis, although it's important to the United States for one set of reasons, is absolutely critical to the Iranian government because it, in effect, saved the revolution and made sure that Khomeini retained power. So if one asks why would the Iranians do such a thing, which basically earned them the distrust of the entire rest of the world, why would they do something like that? Well, their internal politics explains why they would take those kinds of risks and why they would think those risks were worthwhile. And they still do. Though they don't explain it that way, that is in fact what happened. And the hostage crisis was used by Khomeini to save his regime. And basically the creation of a sort of permanent hostility between the United States and Iran was something that he actually welcomed because he thought that the United States had been dominating Iran for all of those years, and you had to have a clean break in order for Iran to operate independently. And he got his way at the end of the day. And the hostage crisis was the single most important thing in terms of making that happen.
Yes, and it seems like, at least from the way you explained it, that it all came down to money, that the Iranians taking the holier-than-thou ground, this really was not a principle-based decision here to release the hostages, but they were after billions and billions of dollars, $24 billion. It seemed to me from reading your fine book that if the United States would have said, sure, here's $24 billion, no problem, they would have said, great. Am I off on that assumption?
The Iranians found themselves in a difficult position because for years the Shah had been placing most of his assets, foreign assets, were actually banked in Chase Manhattan Bank with David Rockefeller. So a tremendous amount of Iranian wealth was in U.S. banks. Also, the Shah had been taking out loans over many years, and those loans were syndicated. So different banks all over the world had a certain responsibility or a certain exposure to those loans. In trying to resolve the hostage crisis, part of the problem was how to resolve the money that Iran had. This is Iranian money. This is not our money. This is Iranian money that was held in the United States, about $12 billion worth. How to resolve that problem for Iran to get its money back and also to take care of all of the other things which came out in the course of the hostage crisis, including all of the companies who had invested in Iran but then had effectively lost everything when the revolution came. They had no equity left. So two things happened. One, Iran got back a portion of its money. Out of $12 billion, they got back around $3 billion, which was a huge cost to them. They lost a tremendous amount of money. In fact, I did a calculation which, given the amount of money that Iran lost in the hostage-taking affair, they paid, in effect, $300,000 per hostage per day for all of the people that they held. That was the real monetary cost, which I think means that nobody is likely to want to repeat that process. But also, one of the good things that came out of it was that there was a court of arbitration created at The Hague to deal with all of the remaining cases about charges against Iran by other companies and the like. And that court still operates. And Iran had to put a huge amount of money into the court in escrow to pay off companies that had claims against the government of Iran and the like. As a result, most of those claims have now been paid off almost entirely. And it was a unique thing, and most people don't understand or remember that that was part of the hostage crisis settlement. But Iran, in the meantime, has paid tens of billions of dollars in paying off claims by various companies, many of them American, against Iran, that Iran has had to be responsible for the payoff. So they lost an enormous amount of money in the course of this event. And I think even people in Iran who felt that the hostage taking was a big mistake looked on this as a tremendous loss that they could ill afford. So getting out of the hostage crisis was extraordinarily costly to Iran, and they lost a great deal.
You didn't really emphasize the election day there in November, and so it seemed like you didn't really pay much mind to that. Was that because after President Carter lost re-election, did the negotiation style with Iran change? And also, was there a desperate attempt to secure the release of the hostages prior to Reagan's inauguration? And if so, why?
Well, Jimmy Carter was absolutely dedicated to getting the hostages out. And that is just a fact. And some of the hostages have been angry at Carter because they held him responsible for the whole affair. And that's fair enough. But no American president could have worked any harder than Jimmy Carter to get those people out of there. The November 4th election was extremely important because Carter had been, in fact, doing everything he possibly could to get the hostages out. The Republicans, the Reagan campaign, was very, very concerned about what they called an October surprise. That is, that Carter would succeed in getting the hostages out, and that would shift the balance of power in the American electorate and would reelect Jimmy Carter. So they took a number of actions. They tried to get in touch with the Iranians. I described that in another book called The October Surprise, and people are free to read it. The bottom line of The October Surprise is that there's no question that the Reagan campaign, and particularly Bill Casey, who became the director of Central Intelligence, did their very best to get in touch with the Iranians to try to persuade them to leave the hostages there until after the election was over. But we don't have any smoking guns. There is no really hard evidence, and we know of parts of a cover-up that have gone on. But the bottom line is that even if one suspects that that's what happened, there's no absolute proof of it. And we're probably not going to get proof until somebody on a deathbed confession or something of the sort actually opens up and explains what really happened. There are a lot of people who know what really happened, but they are mostly intelligence professionals, and they're not talking. But in any event, the election was extraordinarily important because after the election and when all the election politics were over, the Iranians approached the United States with a plan about how to negotiate an end to the hostage crisis using the mediation of a very skilled set of diplomats in Algeria. And they acted as go-betweens. So the Algerians went from Washington to Tehran back and forth, carrying messages, carrying out a negotiation process, which was bumpy and at various points looked as if it had completely failed, but in fact ultimately succeeded, and basically succeeded in the Iranians capitulating. And in January, just before the inauguration of President Reagan, they agreed to pay off all of the loans, which was a terribly costly thing for them to do, and to accept the creation of this court of mediation, which was created in The Hague. And that was the price of getting out of the hostage crisis. These things are very, very complicated. It's like putting sanctions on people. Putting on the sanctions is pretty easy, and taking them off is really quite complicated because all sorts of ramifications have taken place in the meantime, and they interfere with the efforts of trying to lift the sanctions after they're over. Well, the same thing was true with Iran. They had so many fingers in a Western pie in terms of where their money was and all of the loans and where they were located, that undoing all of that turned out to be a lawyer's dream because it was as complicated as it could possibly be. And in the final analysis, the Iranians just threw up their hands and said, okay, we're just going to pay off everything. We'll lose a huge amount of money, but we'll get this thing over with. The hostage crisis had served its purpose. It saved the regime in the sense that Khomeini was now firmly in power. They didn't need the hostages there anymore. It was something that was actually negatively affecting them every single day in their interactions with every other country in the world, and they needed to be done with it. And they knew that if Reagan came in, they would have to start the negotiation process all over again from scratch. And they knew that that could be another year or more of negotiations, and they really didn't want that. So they did what they had to do. They ended the crisis. The hostages were returned on the very day that Reagan took the oath of office. And I think there probably is no other president in American history who actually was working on a major foreign policy issue right up to the very moment when he got in the car to ride out to Capitol Hill to see Reagan take office. Jimmy Carter was fully committed in that. Whatever one thinks of Carter, if I were a hostage, I know that I would really like to have Jimmy Carter as my president because nobody could have worked any harder to end this thing. And in the final analysis, he succeeded. And I think that was probably all the reward that he felt he needed.
You wrote this, obviously, over 30 years ago, and in the introduction you said, "One central fact appeared more certain than others. The Iranian Revolution was very likely to experience a major crisis of legitimacy at some point in its future, and that crisis was likely to occur when the system could no longer depend on the charisma and authority of Khomeini." Khomeini died in 1989. Are you surprised that the regime has lasted as long as it has? And what are your predictions for the regime's future?
Well, very briefly, one of the things that I learned from my experience with the hostage crisis and the Iranian Revolution is that predictions of the downfall of the Iranian government are very common. I've heard those from the very first day of the revolution. And they continue right through to the present. And people think that the Iranian government is tottering and just one little push will bring it down. In my experience, that is a very dangerous assumption. Basically, the regime is remarkably resilient. It has stood up against tremendous pressure. It has fought a war against a really difficult opponent, the Iraqis, who in fact had help from the United States and others. Iran has been isolated for years. And despite all of that, they have survived. So I no longer make predictions about the fact that Iran is going to fall. I think that is a fool's errand. Clearly, this regime is not going to last forever. But my guess is that if and when it falls, it'll be because of the actions of the Iranian people acting on their own, not because they are being pushed into or in some means encouraged by outside forces. The operation of outside forces tends to bring Iranians together and delegitimizes any efforts for change. So by pushing Iran extremely hard, instead of getting Iran to fall, tendency is we actually strengthen it. And I think that's a lesson which, unfortunately, I think the present government in the United States really has not learned, and which I think the Obama administration, for all of the faults and problems that it had, it did understand that basically by bringing Iran into a closer association with the rest of the world, it delegitimized the regime and brought closer the day in which that regime would go. I think we're actually, at this point, strengthening the regime instead of harming it.
Gary Sick. Gary, I want to thank you so much for the time you spent explaining all this to listeners. I want to thank you for such a wonderful book and for educating me the way that you have. And thank you for serving the United States of America for all those years, sir.
Thank you very much. Good to talk to you.